You're listening to Stand Out with Ian O'Connell, Wednesday evenings from 8 p.m. here on Radio Kerry.
Now, you're very welcome to the show tonight. I hope I find you well on this Wednesday evening. I'm delighted to say that my guest this week on Stand Out with myself, Ian O'Connell, is Claire Walsh. Claire is an Irish free diver from County Kildare. She represents Ireland in the sport that is known to be the second most dangerous sport in the world, that being free diving. Claire can hold her breath for 5 minutes and 59 seconds and dives more than 60 metres down. Sit back and enjoy the show.
Claire, thanks a million for joining me today. How are you keeping?
Great. I'm in super form this Monday morning.
super form. Tea or coffee on a morning? What's your go-to?
Always coffee.
Yeah.
Always coffee.
Have to. I can't go. I'd say if I went without the morning, without coffee, I'd be very cranky.
Like, how sad is this? I go to bed excited for my morning coffee. Kind of pathetic, but hey, that's my life right now.
Look forward to the first sip.
Yeah, absolutely.
I always like to, I suppose, bring my guests back to their childhood growing up. Do you want to paint a picture for the listeners? What were you like, I suppose, growing up, and were you interested in sports or?
So I grew up in County Kildare, in Leixlip, which, as you know, is landlocked. It's not exactly on the coast. It's not by the sea. It's not too far away. But Kildare is obviously more known for its race courses than its roaring waves.
Yeah.
I'm the eldest of 4 kids. I have 2 sisters and a brother. Growing up, I wasn't particularly into sports. Well, when I say that, yeah, no, I wasn't at all. But I swam. That was something that I've done from, I think, you know, I was a couple of months old when Dad first took me into the pool. And then all throughout our childhood, we all went swimming on Saturday evenings as a family, and then Saturday mornings as well. And then maybe a Tuesday night and maybe a Thursday night as well. So kind of from 2, I guess, up until 18, I swam at least 2, 3, 4 times a week.
Really?
Swimming was always a part of my childhood, but I definitely wouldn't consider myself sporty.
And would you say if Kildare are playing now in the football, would you watch that?
No.
No.
It was a while ago now. I'm going back a good while. Kildare were doing really well. And my family had tickets and kind of we took turns going. But I said, it's not fair. It is wasted on me.
Yeah.
So I gave the tickets to my sisters or brother, whoever, and they would get much more mileage out of it. I'd watch it. I think it's an incredible sport. Watching Gar Hurling on TV, but no, I wouldn't follow it.
Wouldn't be. Do you have a background in theatre? I don't know. Was there?
I do, yeah. And I think just when I mentioned swimming, I remember it came a time, I think I was around 13, 14, where I needed to up my training in swimming in terms of, you know, regularity. So going in the morning and after school. But I was also doing drama, which I had done, I think we were 5 or 6 when we started drama, or when I started drama, speech and drama. And it became a little bit of a choice between the two, and I picked drama.
You'd often see that with, I suppose, people growing up, that they have to pick between 2 different things.
Yeah, like they were both pretty time consuming, and I wanted to be in plays. I wanted to do shows. I wanted to do, you know, competitions. So it was one or the other. And I picked drama, and probably still would to this day. And then I ended up after school, I did a BA in drama performance in DIT. And then went on and did a master's in movement for theatre in London, which
really,
even having done it, I still don't know exactly what that means. It's kind of a random qualification, but I learned a lot that has applied to different areas of my life over the years.
Good to you know, try, I suppose, new things, you know, especially at like a young age. Like I my guests often say, like, it's about taking part really as a child, you know, making friends and that kind of side of thing is just as important as doing the sport, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think like whether it's a sport or drama or whatever activity it is that you're into, you definitely learn things that stand to you years later.
Yeah.
So, for example, I did a TED talk at the weekend. So I'm really proud of that. I loved every second of it. And someone commented afterwards, you didn't seem that nervous before you went on. And I said, oh, I was. But I do have a long back, you know, an extensive background, I guess, in performance. So I have my routine.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was nervous, but I know how to deal with it. And even though I haven't done any performance in 3 or 4 years, I know, like, I need to go off by myself. I spend a little bit of time doing some breathing, calming me down. Then I have my routine. I put on my makeup and I do vocal warm-ups. Yeah. And then I make sure, you know, I'm drinking water and so on. So it's all little rituals that I've developed over the years that you kind of just don't pay attention to. You just do. And then when it comes down to it, they really, really help. And boy, was I glad of those at the weekend.
It's the small little things before people don't see. I suppose moving on then from growing up to, I suppose, your path going into freediving. Did you book a flight to South America? And Yep. Is that where you found your love for freediving? Or was it something that you liked growing up?
I'd never heard of it up until 2015. Like, it's funny, since then, so what, obviously 8 years, it's a lot more mainstream, more people are trying it. But in 2015, I was traveling through South and Central America, and I'd never heard of it.
Really?
I first saw it. So my first memory of freediving, even though I didn't know what I was looking at the time, was in the Galapagos. And I've described this many, many times. We were doing like a snorkeling trip, you know, a day trip that people don't do. Excuse me. And I got in the water. They were kind of stopping for lunch. I got in the water having a splash around. And one of the lads from the boat came in with me, and he was a local. So we had you know, snorkel, a mask and a set of fins on. And I was lying on my belly looking into the water. Now, below me was all the color fish you can imagine. There was turtles. In that spot, I think there was penguins. So there was so much to see. There were reef sharks. It was mind blowing. But the guy who was with me, he took a breath, obviously, folded from his waist and started kicking down. I honest to God forgot that he wasn't breathing.
Really?
He was amazing. And amid all these things that you can see, I could see, I was glued to him.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, that is the closest thing I will ever see to a merman in my entire life. But I didn't know that was freediving.
Yeah.
A couple of months later, I was somewhere else, Belize, I think it was. And again, another kind of day trip. And all my trips were usually based around water. So it was another snorkeling trip. And I was with a group of Aussie lads, and they kicked down and went into a cave and came back out the other side. Now, I tried to keep up, but my ears stopped me. So I asked them, what was that?
Yeah.
And how do you do it? So they explained it was free diving. They had done a course in it. And that night, I was in Belize, and I booked a boat on a train and a plane and a whatever to get over to an island off Honduras to do my first freediving course.
And would I be right, Claire, in saying that you, I think I'm right in saying, was it like 2 weeks after a French diver passed away? Was that
right? Yeah, that's right.
Our second name, because
Her son actually just set another world record at the weekend, diving to 133 meters, which that's not even another level. That's seven levels above. It is out of this world sort of achievement. But Natalia, I remember I arrived in Utila. I was just about to make my way down. And, you know, obviously I've been Googling free diving, kind of learning a bit more about it, and you know, this thing came up. They're kind of, really? And at that point, I didn't know who she was. I didn't understand, you know, her stature in the freediving community. You know, everyone has nothing but respect for her. So, but she meant nothing to me at the time. So I was like, oh gosh, well, maybe she was, I don't know. You just didn't know. So it's funny, you know, kind of having that in your mind and then beginning to learn the sport, then you learn what she achieved in her life. It's a humbler, and I think her death is one of the ones where it puts it in perspective. If she, one of the top people ever in the sport, can, you know, have an accident, then anyone can. So just it's just one of those reminders that.
Did you second guess yourself going into the first lesson?
No, I don't think so. I think I compartmentalized it quite well.
Yeah.
But it's just one of those reminders. There are rules and you stick by those rules. And yeah. If you ever think that you are exempt from them and you think, I'm just going to go and do a little 10 meter dive, I try and bring it back to that weekend in 2015. Well, actually, this happened to her. If it happens to her, it can happen to me. So I need to just do as much as I can to be safe.
It is. It's a humbler like that. I suppose, realize that a most professional can have that accident and somebody, you know, just a normal Joe Bloke thing today can go down, and it's crazy. I wanted to ask you, because one of the things that fascinates me, going down is one thing, but holding your breath. Was it 5 minutes and 59 seconds your record was?
5:59 is my personal best.
That second, does it ever play with your head, that second?
Of course it does. I've never got over 6, and it's funny, my depth personal best is 59 meters. So you can see there's something there with the sixes that is messing with my head. Look, you know, of course I'd love to go back training. I hopefully will soon enough, and conquer the sixes. But that discipline where it's measured in time is lying on the surface of the water. So that will typically be your longest breath hold, and you're lying perfectly still. It's really challenging, but there's a lot of learning from it.
And say when you were going into the sport, Claire, how do you build? Because this is what always fascinates me, and even Tom Cruise there in one movie, he done his own stunt holding the breath. How do you go about, I suppose, training yourself into holding it? Is there a certain breath exercises, I presume?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of preparation you do before a breath hold, and typically we'd call that your breathe up. So that's using your breath to relax your body, relax your mind, slow your thoughts down, lower your heart rate. You know, you're doing everything you can to be as efficient as possible. And that's efficient with movement, with thought, with, you know, letting go of tension. So you're being as efficient as you can with oxygen. And that prepares you for the breath hold. But so much of it is mental. So much of it is how you can switch off, how you can observe without judging, how much you can kind of fight through feelings of discomfort. So for me, the preparation is primarily mental.
Yeah. And I heard you on a podcast, I don't know, it was with Carol Henridge, you know, the guy from Operation Transformation. And I seen a few times that they say it's the second most dangerous sport in the world, and I'm kind of saying, what's the first most dangerous?
Still don't know the answer to that one. I think it's base jumping, but it's funny. Second most dangerous sport in the world is, there's a real sense in the freediving community of, I think, exhaustion with that. Like, that title is used anytime there's. I recently wrote a book, and yeah, engaged in some really lovely interviews, but the headline will always be second most dangerous sport. It is clickbait, and in some ways it does the sport a real disservice.
Yeah.
It just sensationalizes it. There's no doubt that there's a danger to it, but there's a danger to a lot of things. And
there's a danger in walking across the road, isn't there?
Yeah, and I'm really not being flippant about it, because we are really, as free divers, and certainly any divers I dive or train with, we're really conscientious about the rules, about our safety, about calculating risk. And sometimes we decide not to dive, and sometimes we call each other out. And, you know, there's a real sense of respect for your own safety, but also for the safety of those that you dive with. So, you know, this title of second most dangerous sport in the world, it's a really tough one. In one way, we want more people to learn about the sport. We want more people to try it. But when that headline is out there, like, many of us can't hire lanes and pools, because the people who own the pools and the centers and managers think it's too dangerous because of this headline that they keep reading. In fact, a person I know, he tried to hire a lane in a swimming pool. He's an instructor. He has his own insurance. He tried to hire a lane, and they wouldn't let him. And he asked why, and he said, because of Claire Walsh's book.
Go away.
Because it says it's the second most dangerous sport in the world. And actually, there's a chapter in my book called Second Most Dangerous Sport in the World. But what I do in that chapter is dispel all the myths and the perceptions about it. So you can see how people just take the headline, don't read the article or don't read the explanation, and they hold that in their head and attach it to freediving. So, yeah, it's dangerous. There's no doubt about that. But there are rules. There are so many measures in place to keep divers safe, and that significantly reduces risk.
And like you said, it kind of does it a disservice when people see most dangerous. Some people are like, "Oh, I'm not going near that." Whereas, and like you said, it's all kind of, I suppose, clickbait in one sense. Like you said there, Claire, you've done a book there recently. Just, I suppose, now it's a good chance to just say a few words on that for the listeners. How did that come about? Does it just go through your journey coming into the sport?
So my story is based around freediving, but it's not really a freediving book. At least I don't think so. In fact, there was a a review on Goodreads, I think, or one of the sites, that said, "I thought there'd be more freediving." I was like, "You didn't read the blurb, pal." It's much of my story, and certainly my story probably centers around, or has a lot to do with, mental illness that I experienced in my 20s and 30s, and probably to this day, and how I use the tools of freediving to help me work through it. So the book is called Underwater: How Holding My Breath Taught Me to Live.
Very good. And like you said, it's not all focused on freediving for the whole thing. I wanted to ask you there, you just mentioned about mental health, and it's such a topic at the moment, and you know, it needs to be talked about 10 times more if you ask me. I wanted to ask you, going through, like, you always see there on Instagram, people doing ice baths. Do you think that, maybe you've done them yourself, do you think that ice baths do kind of, I suppose, bring anxiety down and stress levels?
Well, to be dead honest with you, I'm not up enough on the science of cold water exposure and like ice baths and stuff like that. Anything I say is more anecdotal. I don't do ice baths, but I do swim in the sea every day, all year round. So yeah, that's pretty cold. It's not as cold as an ice bath. And for me, submerging in cold water, there is a whole science around it, and it's lots to do with vagal tone, the vagus nerve, regulating. And, you know, there are people who explain it a lot better than I do. For me, cold water is about coming back into my body. It's very difficult to think about to-do lists and what you should and shouldn't be doing when you're submerged. It really is, you know, it's a full body experience. It brings you right into the moment. And that's the benefit for me. Automatically, when I'm doing that, I'm focusing on my breathing. I'm thinking about the now. I'm thinking about relaxing, which, as far as I know, and I'm open to correction, is a really big part of using ice baths as well.
Yeah, and you'll often see people saying that as well, that on Instagram, they're after becoming so popular now. Yeah. If you don't mind, I wanted to ask you, leading up to a dive, Claire, say 10 minutes before the dive, obviously you're going to your gear, your wetsuit and that kind of side of things. But I suppose mentally, like you said, you probably do breathing before. Yeah. What's 10 minutes before you do one like?
10 minutes before a dive, typically I'll be in the water. I'll have, so there's the main dive line and then there'll be warm-up line. So I'll have done my warm-up dives at that point. So I would hope to get on the competition line kind of 4 to 5 minutes. 5 minutes is amazing. Before the dive, so before official top, so that's your dive time, official top. So 10 minutes before official top, I will be somewhere nearby. I will usually keep my face in the water, so I'll have a snorkel on. I'll have a snorkel in my mouth, and I'll try and keep my ears submerged. I am wearing a full hood, but what I want to do is just try and eliminate the sound that's around me. I don't want to pay attention to who's diving before me. I don't want to hear if they've succeeded or if they failed. I don't want to hear people chatting. I really just want to bring my attention in to myself. So I breathe. If I find my attention or focus starting to stray, 9 times out of 10, I'll sing. I'll sing to myself in the water, which sounds crazy through the snorkel. I sound like a demented whale, but it makes me smile. It helps me breathe, and it just gives my brain a little bit of an anchor. Something to kind of come back to when there's lots and lots of distraction going on around me. I really need to keep the focus quite narrow just before a dive.
To kind of stay in the moment. Do you know the lines that you are kind of attached to? Yeah. I always wondered, how far down do they go, and are they just weighted at the bottom, or how do they stay down there?
So in terms of how far do they go down, it's movable. And the night before, the diver will announce the depth that they're going to attempt. So let's say I'm going for that 60 meter dive and putting a 6 on my watch. I'll write that on a piece of paper, Claire Walsh, Ireland, 60 meters, and then the discipline. So just before my dive, and actually usually in that 10 minutes, once the diver ahead of me, let's say she's gone to 70. So they're going, okay, Ian has dived to 70. Next up, we have Claire. Claire has dived to 60. Okay, lads. So they need to pull the rope up a little bit, 10 meters, obviously, to 60. At the bottom is the bottom weight, and that obviously keeps it down. And there's also a plate. And attached to that plate are loads and loads and loads of Velcro tags. And when you get down to the bottom, you pull a tag off, and I pop it in my hood usually, and you come back up. So that tag is a part of the dive. So when you get to the surface, you do a protocol, and they'll ask you, do you have a tag? And producing a tag is part of getting a clean dive.
And what if you lost the tag on the way up?
That has happened, not to me, thankfully, but it just means that it's not a full 100% dive. You're docked points.
That'd be my luck to go down and lose it.
I remember his friend of mine, his name is Ed. He's a Honduran diver. He was super. There's also a camera that goes down, Dive Eye. So his.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's cool. So, and it looks like a giant minion. It's yellow, has one eye or one camera. So Ed went down on his way up. I don't know if he had it in his hand or his hood, but it popped out in front of him. Now, luckily, he saw it. And as part of his stroke, he was able to grab it. But it is the funniest footage. Like, typically, you know, at depth, they're certainly coming back up. You're not doing any extra movements. So you certainly wouldn't be going back down for a tag, or you wouldn't be swiping for it, because that could make the difference in staying conscious on the surface. and blacking out, using up any more energy that you need to. But the photos, or, you know, stills of the footage on Dive Eye of Ed grabbing his tag is hilarious.
And it's that,
he got it.
It's that, like, if it goes away from you, you can swim out because you're still attached to the line, aren't you?
Yeah, you're not going to do anything. Those sort of things are when you're moving into more dangerous territory.
And you mentioned there when you started in looking down all the different color fish. I know whenever I'm in Spain or holidays or anywhere, and even when I was in the pool when I was like 8, I'd always ask the lifeguard if there was jellyfish. They were the one thing that used to drive me mad. Have you had any encounters in, say, like going down in any country like that? You see a shark or anything?
So where I dive in Dahab, there's lots and lots of moon jellyfish. So they're quite small and they're pink. Like they're tiny and there's loads of them. Yeah. So very often you just get stung going down. So, I look like I've just gotten fillers in my lips. When I come back up, they're starting to swell a little bit. They sting, but they're not too sore. And I have had a remora. So it's big enough. I was down at the bottom. I don't think it was a deep dive. I think it was like 30 meters or something. And I was doing what's called a hang. So you're down and you just pause. So you wouldn't do this at depth. This is kind of done in training and for lots of different reasons. So I was holding on. Let's say I was at 30 meters. I was just counting in my head. And I just saw this fish coming towards my mask. And he just pooped that my mask. Yeah. And then swam away.
That'd be my biggest fear, a jellyfish on the way down. And when I was reading up about the sport layer, it says after 20 meters, do you like free fall down or is there something like that?
Yeah, so that really depends on the diver and also how we're weighted, because we wear weights.
Yeah.
For me, free fall starts about 23 meters. That's very specific. About usually around 23 meters is kind of what I have in my head. And that is by far the nicest part of the dive for me. And it's funny, I spoke to a pal of mine, Stig Priest, of which I never pronounce his surname properly. He's a Danish diver and he's super. He's a different league to me. But he's training in Dahab at the moment in Egypt. And I asked him, tell me one lovely thing about being back in the water again. I just wanted to live vicariously. And he said, oh man, the free fall. So we just geeked.
Is it just peaceful, like going down by yourself?
It's incredible for me. My favorite thing about it is it's so quiet.
Yeah.
It's funny. It feels very safe. Like you're kind of cocooned. You know, you're feeling the water rushing over you, the parts of you that are exposed, like so hands, face, feet. You can feel the water getting colder and rushing over you. It's kind of like a liquid hug. It's amazing. In terms of the dive itself, it's quite a dreamlike state or kind of a sleepy state. You don't have to do anything. Your only job is to stay relaxed. So it's a really, really beautiful part of any dive. It is one I think about when I'm lying in bed at night.
It's like you're at one with the water. And like you said, your friend there, he's training over that side of the world. Have you any, I suppose you've done it in loads of places as well. Have you any one either country or one area of the sea that you just, it was just different, that you absolutely loved? Or is it even in Ireland?
You know what? I haven't done enough in Ireland I have to remedy that this summer. I don't know if it's my favorite, but certainly very special to me is the Blue Hole in Egypt. It's where I've been to most. I met my husband there. I met some really incredible friends there. So it is somewhere that's very, very special to me. The Blue Hole, Dahab in Egypt. It's something else.
It stands out more than the others. I wanted to ask you, obviously, the whole thing in the last 2-3 weeks was the Titan that went down. That was obviously, everyone knows what happened. When I was watching a documentary on it, they were on about pressure going down. as a diver, when you go down, obviously you're not going to be going down as far as the Titanic, but as you were going down, can you feel the pressure, like, say, like your ears popping or anything like that?
Yeah. So when there's a group of free divers at dinner, we tend to only talk about free diving.
Really?
And there are two things that we will always talk about. EQ, which means equalization, and that refers to popping ears, and also pressure.
Yeah.
It's almost like bingo. If you mention EQ or if you mention pressure, you have to take a drink because it gets really, really boring. So EQ, so it's the popping of ears, and there's a whole scale. It's a really, really, really fundamental part of depth and managing that, as well as managing the pressure. And a lot of that is to do with things you do outside the water, kind of developing a flexibility in your chest. And also, I think I mentioned it earlier on, you know, your only job is to stay relaxed. So when you're feeling that pressure, it's very easy to tense up. And when you tense up, that causes knock-on problems to your EQ or your equalization. And that's when you can sustain injuries as well. So focusing on staying relaxed, you know, amid this pressure is one of the big challenges of diving to depth.
And would you ever, Tev, even yourself, would you, I suppose, one of the commenting, like, I'm only guessing that people can lose consciousness either going down or coming up. Has anything ever happened to you where, I suppose, you kind of blacked out or anything around that?
So it would be pretty unusual to lose consciousness on the way down. Really? Usually the most events or blackouts happen in the last 10 meters on the way up. And that's lots to do with partial pressure and so on. Yeah, I have blacked out, not particularly proudly, but it has happened to me. The most notable was my first dive of the World Championships in 2019. I blacked out on the surface. I've not, touch wood, blacked out underwater.
Touch wood is right. Just one or two more things before we finish up. You said there about the championships. What was that like, I suppose, going over there? And when you represent Ireland, obviously it's a very proud thing to do in any sport. Or...
I don't even know if pride fully covers it. It was incredible. Like I said, I wasn't a very sporty child. So to find a sport and represent your country at, I don't know, how old was I? 36 at the time. It's incredible. It's absolutely incredible. Like, I suppose, and this is what I cover essentially in my book, my achievement isn't that I'm the best diver or the deepest diver by a long shot, but my achievement was I was there. I put myself out there. I trained, I prepared. And I think, yeah, like I said, the main thing is put myself out there. So by the time I got to the World Championships, kind of almost the hard work was done, or the achievement was already made or ticked, the box ticked. But that, the night before the competition started, there was an opening ceremony and there was a parade where, you know, you held a placard with Ireland on that night, the flag around my neck, and my sister, brother-in-law and nephew were there, actually carried my nephew in my arm for a bit. That is probably one of my all-time favorite memories.
And is free diving, is it an Olympic sport? No.
No, it's not.
Do you think it ever will?
I don't know. I think how it looks. So, you know, at a competitive level and certainly at a high competitive level, you know, blackouts are far more a feature of the sport because, for example, Alexei, you know, Mulchanov, he just did 133 meters. So when people are diving to that level of depth, there are more blackouts. And I think how they can look can be pretty scary. I can't imagine it'll ever be part of the Olympics, but I could be wrong. It'd be like amazing.
Even talking to you here for the last while, you seem, I suppose, you seem, I don't know if you're competitive, like for myself. I remember when I was playing sport, I didn't like losing. But like you said there, even at dinners with other divers, it seems to have, and I suppose when you're doing such a a dangerous thing. Everybody has a certain level of respect for each other. Is it very competitive between divers, like, or is it, are you obviously respectful to each other?
Yeah, I don't think so. Like I'd be so naive to say that it isn't. Obviously, other people can fire you up, but I'm not, you know, like, I don't think I'm going to ever be competing for world records. So for me, I'm doing it for myself. I'm competing with me. I'm competing with me of 4 years ago. I'm competing with me of 5, 6, 7 years ago. And now I have long COVID. So I have respiratory issues and chronic fatigue. So that sense of competitiveness has somewhat shifted. And I do just want to get back in the water. Competing isn't as big a thing for me now as it would have been at the end of 2019, when I couldn't wait to get going again. My perspective has shifted, my goals have shifted, and I suppose I want to explore what I can do. I want to see how far I can go. And I'm not saying a competitive element won't come into it at some point, but I think right now I will be happy to just have that feeling of free fall again. I would be happy to be immersed in the community. So when I said, you know, whether it's competitive or not, what it does have is a really strong sense of community. Like that, I spoke to Stig on the phone the other day. Yesterday, I got a message from another freediving friend in America saying congratulations on the TED Talk. You know, we have a network of people all over the world, and it's a really, really tight community.
It's amazing to hear. Last question is, like you said there, fatigue is a very big part of it. What would be the most common, I suppose, injuries or sicknesses that comes along? Because obviously it's an incredible sport, and it's not a contact sport, but I'd imagine there is still niggles and injuries that come about.
Yeah, like what might prevent you getting in the water is, if I was training, if I was in Egypt right now, a reason that I might not be in the water is maybe a cold, blocked sinuses, because that can stop you equalizing. That can kind of cause havoc. The same with ears. So if you've an ear infection, or if your ears feel sore, that would always keep me out of the water. Beyond that, you know, it's quite easy to overtrain. It's a stress on your nervous system, quite unlike any other thing or sports that I've experienced. So it's very easy to overtrain. And once you get to that point of having overtrained, it takes a long time to recoup that energy. So when I'm training, I'll always try and err on the side of caution. I haven't done a big training regime since I have long COVID, so I don't know how my body would handle it now. I would guess I would have to, it would be day one on, day two off, day one on, day two off, which it's funny, when you're training, you just want to do more. Like, you want to do as many days as possible, but that'll scupper your chances down the road.
And for anyone in Ireland that wants to get involved in free diving, Claire, because I anyone I interview sports, I ask them how can they get involved, how would they go about, I suppose, trying free diving.
My biggest piece of advice is take a course. I know there's lots and lots of YouTube videos out there, and it can seem like skills that you can learn, but take a course with someone who knows what they're doing, with a professional, and learn the proper techniques, but most of all, learn the proper safety.
Absolutely. And your book, Underwater, where can people pick that up? Or
Underwater is published by Gale Publishers and is available in all good bookstores.
Brilliant. Claire, thanks so much for your time, though, and I enjoyed that chat, though. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And if you're looking for any more information on freediving, books, whatever, people can find me at clairewalshlife.com or at clairewalshlife on Insta.
Mm-hmm. Brilliant. Thanks a million, Claire.
Cheers. Thank you so much. Lovely to chat.
You too.
Now, unfortunately, that's all we've time for tonight. I hope you all enjoyed the show, and as always, I appreciate you tuning in to me. A massive thanks to Claire for coming in tonight and having a chat about her own story and about what she's achieved in the sport of freediving and the short couple of years that she's been at it. It's a it's a phenomenal thing to be able to do, to hold your breath for that long. I suppose I'm speaking for myself, and I'm sure everyone else listening to this, as we were a child in the swimming pools, we'd try and hold our breath for underwater for as long as we can. And I don't know about you, but I could only hold her for about 30 seconds and I'd be up gasping for air. If you have any questions or requests for next week's show, you can contact me through my Instagram, enoconnell321, or through my email address, ioconnell@radiokerry.ie. Stay tuned into Radio Kerry, because Brian Priestley is up next with That's Jazz. I'll be back at the same time next Wednesday night from 8 to 9 p.m. Until then, stay safe and mind yourself.
You're listening to Standout with Enoconnell, Wednesday evenings from 8 p.m. here on Radio Kerry.